Mitchell, I have a question for you about the 2003 protests. Do you have a general ballpark of the ratio of electronic to paper complaints that was made to the FCC? Because as I read that and thought about that, 15 times larger, which is wow, wouldn't that be fantastic if we had 50 million protests?
Right.
But if the people who are going to protest are the people who don't have the access to the internet, who are not high information convertees, then if this is depending on paper protests, we need a lot of stamps and envelopes.
Right. So what's the ratio? Details for that, I don't know, because I don't think that the FCC actually made that public. The 3 million number comes from an estimate from the office of Jonathan Adelstein, an FCC commissioner. What we do know, because we actually heard this from the National Rifle Association, they had deployed, and this is no joke, you will find that in these instances, you will find a very interesting tactical coalition, as it's called, where groups that usually would never agree on anything in a million years are suddenly aligning on matters like this.
There was even a thing called Strange Bedfellows.
Yeah, the Strange Bedfellows phenomenon, the tactical coalition phenomenon, where people that are usually on opposite sides of the political spectrum are suddenly uniting for a single cause, and that's not inconsiderable. The numbers, at least that the NRA said with regards to matters like, for example, the postcard turnout campaign that they had said, might have been in the ballpark of maybe 1 million. Could have been as high as 2 million. Unfortunately, we don't know that because the number, the authoritative number for that lies with the FCC, and they just haven't said. What we're hearing is the estimate that they got. It was considerable to a great extent, and the numbers, yeah, you're right. It's probably going to have to be not just the people who are going to comment in on the FCC's website or make a call to their representative in Congress or whatever, post on their blog some commentary about this. And that's not considerable either. Upwards of 50 million blogs worldwide with the number growing all the time. Yeah, that certainly will get increased attention. But also things like writing a letter, sending in a fax, filling out your name on a postcard and mailing it in. I mean, it's going to have to be that, and it could well be that. I mean, we saw that with regards to the FCC. The ratio, we don't know. Figure, I'm going to guess 50-50, but unless we hear from the FCC, who knows? Good question. We may never know.
I've heard a lot of talk about how this is somehow going to democratize television and broadcasting in general. I mean, I understand that there's going to be an enormous amount of more channels that you can fit into the same broadcast space, but really there's a massive barrier of entry of who can actually talk over those airwaves. Mm-hmm. So how does it really democratize what's going on with broadcasting?
Part of the way, I mean, first of all, you're exactly right that, you know, broadcasters still control who gets on to a certain extent. But I think the notion here is that people are hoping, whether or not it actually materializes or not, that a certain portion of the digital spectrum gets allocated into hyper-local programming of some sort. And through that hyper-local programming, there's opportunities for citizens groups or whatever to have some access, whether it's through weekly programs or other kinds of things. That sort of thing, I think, as I addressed earlier, I think is probably more likely to emerge out of local public broadcasting stations, whether they're PBS or others, rather than out of commercials. I think commercial channels will try to do it initially. You've already seen a push in that and things like covering high school football games, you know, in digital tier, which, yeah, I recognize is, you know, it's kind of silly, but that's, you know, they're going for the lowest common denominator.
It's not silly. It has to do with my interest in sports.
Yeah. He was a panelist on a workshop just yesterday on this.
That's a big thing. But I think that if you get into more controversial and true democratization of that hyperlocal stream, I think it's too dangerous for commercial broadcasters. I'm not saying that it should be. I'm just saying that I think that economically they will make the decision that at some point that it becomes too dangerous. And at the point that they begin to vet the content in order to mitigate the risks in their economic algorithm, then it loses its value as, you know, as true democratization of the content. So I think ultimately that gets undermined.
There is a historical precedent for this, which is that in the early days of radio, when broadcasters were attempting to fill, you know, they had like 12-hour licenses, for example, and the FCC said that, or back then the FRC, Federal Radio Commission, said that if you don't fill those 12 hours, or at least a certain percentage of them, then we're going to yank your license. And so the response of many broadcasters, especially unaffiliated with NBC and CBS, was to bring in the Glee Club, was to bring in the Boy Scouts, was to bring in the churches, was to bring in the local Red Cross for safety lectures and things like that. And there was this enormous outpouring of citizen-produced content. As the economics of the industry changed, that time became finally, the Depression kind of lifted a little bit in the late 30s, and there was, they were able to sell this time, and so that window didn't close entirely, but it closed significantly. And it is a fair question whether something like this may repeat, where certain, at least authorized groups, because all the groups that I named are like authorized, it's not mm-hmm. some crank with his, whatever, like me or you.
Yeah, me.
Yeah.
Not me, though.
The difference, though, now is that there are so many commercial providers of content. Mm-hmm. Nobody has to try to figure out where you're going to get stuff to fill. I mean, you look at the local Austin market multicasting at the digital tier. And even us, we're guilty of it, and initially out of the box. We have 18.1, 18.2. 18.1 is the standard PBS feed. It's in HD 24/7. 18.2 is a pass-through channel called Create that comes down from PBS that's, how-to and travel and lifestyle stuff. And the battle we're having internally right now is, do we reserve 18.3 as sort of an experimental localized channel, which is what, what some of us want to do, or do we pass through and bring down another pass-through channel? And the one that we'd probably bring down would be a channel called Veme, which is 24/7 PBS quality Spanish language programming. Mm-hmm. And there's a strong advocacy for Veme in this community with 35% Latino population. So it would be really easy to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wouldn't have to do anything. Just signal on it, no cost, no playlist, none of that stuff. But I think it's the wrong strategic thing for us to do. Channel 42 or Channel 36, when they brought up their secondary, no, it was 42, I think it was. It brought up their secondary multicast channel. They brought in Retro TV. Mm-hmm. Channel 24 on its secondary DTV channel runs a weatherman. Nobody has really begun to pioneer true local content that would achieve that democratization yet. And I think that's a risky thing.
Is there any incentive for them to? With the model that we have, broadcasting model, is there an incentive?
It's sort of a Saul Alinsky thing, how do you organize the middle class? And part of it, mm-hmm. from a broadcaster standpoint, is you go after high school football teams. you say the incentive for me to localize is because I think there's this mass audience out there of rabid parents who would love to get on their cell phones and send me a cell phone video of a local high school game for Friday night that I could slap up on my local multicast. And that sounds good in concept, but I think ultimately it becomes, one thing I have learned in this, my short time I've been doing this, good local production, no matter what your objective, is expensive. It doesn't generate the eyeballs in the long run that American Idol does or that Wife Swap does. It it doesn't get the underwriter dollars or the advertising dollars, and so economically, I think over the shorter long run, I don't think it works out.
At National Conference for Media Reform that was held about 3 months ago in Minneapolis, FCC Commissioner Michael Koss addressed the very question you just posed with regards to, broadcasters are getting this huge new windfall of digital channels, what are you doing with it? The only examples he could cite as far as people who were doing something substantial was PBS, taking the channels and actually putting on content. When you actually addressed the question to a number of commercial broadcast executives and said, what are you doing with this stuff? In Michael Copps' words, their response was they looked at their feet, meaning they, for the most part, had no plans, maybe for just taking a digital version of what they're already doing on a broadcast channel for this. And in fact, you'll find an article, Bruce Dixon, on the website for called Black Agenda Report, wrote a commentary about this, referring to the number that he had cited was 5,100 digital channels that are basically being hoarded by commercial broadcasters to basically prevent that humongous windfall for, you name it. It could be broadcasting local high school games, it could be broadcasting stuff that people send in from their cell phones, it could be soliciting in particular content. I actually helped produce a TV show myself on Chicago's public access channel, CAN-TV, as well as also airs on Dish Network, on the channel Free Speech TV, and on iTunes, and on YouTube, a TV show called Chicago Independent Television, an affiliate of the Chicago Independent Media Center that kind of serves as a magazine profile of
political activism in Chicago on the themes of social justice and social rights. That show could fall into this. In fact, I'm actually hoping that WTTW, Chicago's main PBS affiliate, will pick it up. Maybe they could put it on a digital channel that they're going to get. But the point is that there's this, and especially also where public access channels are, could themselves also serve as a kind of resource for content to fill up this time on broadcast channels. You look at them and see if the channels and the standards are up to snuff, and maybe take some of the better ones and put them on that to help fill that up. There are, I think, some possibilities here that only PBS, at least thus far, has been doing, but for economic reasons about preventing that windfall from being used other than to basically make private profit at the public expense, at least I think.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that we turn to PBS affiliates as the answer for where we're going to go to restore the public. But of course, when we had the opportunity to fund PBS's conversion to digital, mm-hmm. there were no dollars. I mean,
not true. Absolutely not true.
Yeah, how did that work out?
You know, I think part of the reason why PBS is out in front. And I don't want to defend the commercial channels, believe me, because I spent a lot of time on the other side. But, you know, to the defense of the commercial channels looking at their feet, their objective is to maximize their return to their shareholders. Mm-hmm. PBS has received funding from the federal government through the Digital Distribution Program and the Public Telecommunications Facilities Program for several years to support the cost of the DTV conversion. That's the reason why PBS stations were ahead of most of the commercial stations in the integration of digital broadcast stuff into master control. Here in Austin, for example, we did a local capital campaign of $5 million. Local contributions came in from supporters and donors. We've received probably, half of that was probably used for matching against funds received from the federal government, so probably $2.5 to $3 million from the feds. There was $1 million that came from the state through a $20 million grant that came from the Telecommunications Infrastructure Fund that went to the public broadcasters, the 13 public broadcasters in Texas, to support the creation of a Texas Public Broadcasting Network. So there's been a lot of government money poured into our stations, thank heavens, that have given us this lead. And so, you know, I'd have to say that, again, in all candor, I think that given the amount of lead time that we have on this digital transition and the opportunities that we might have had to multicast and use multicasting creatively, I think we're behind where we should be.
So you feel like it's actually been a reasonably well-funded conversion?
I think that, you know, one could argue that that it's never enough, but I think in terms of looking at the pattern of PBS stations coming online with digital broadcast, yeah, I think it's been adequately funded such that probably 90, I don't know what the number is, one of you guys may know, 95% I think of PBS stations are now broadcasting digitally and have been for some time.
How do you think it's broken down across the state with the smaller stations that tend to be more often repeater stations, that kind of thing?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Generally, the formulas tend to allocate the dollars relatively well, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, irrespective of, you know, leanings of the top administration at the bureaucrat level, tends to try to give a real consideration to the smaller stations versus the larger stations, and there have been some smaller station-specific grants, smaller market grants. So I think it probably, I would guess, this is, you know, purely guess, I think proportionally it would probably tend to balance out over time.
But you're not hearing a lot of squawking.
No, and there's a lot of money being thrown in right now, particularly through the Digital Distribution Fund, for those stations that still have some hurdles to cross. The last two rounds of the DDF have been focused specifically on bringing station master controls up to digital standard if there's still weaknesses in the infrastructure. So, you know, most of that has had to be financed out of private dollars in the commercial broadcast marketplace. And you know, I think that they're going to put that off as long as they can.
Yeah. I had a question about, I think one of the things we're talking about is the public interest obligations of broadcasters in this new digital era. And I was actually wondering if there's actually been a concrete conversation or policy plan. I came across a document maybe a few weeks ago. It's an older document that Al Gore had put together a commission to debate and discuss what should be the new public interest obligations of digital broadcasters back in 1999. It was a really fascinating group of people, from people from CBS alongside public interest advocates. Cass Sunstein was on there. It's sort of a good hodgepodge group, and they came up with a fairly good redefinition of the terms of a license for a digital broadcaster in this new era. So I was just wondering if any of you knew about it or had any follow-up.
I've seen the report, but I don't know where it is.
Yeah, I've been talking with Charles Benton of the Benton Foundation about this stuff. We've been involved in conference calls. My life is weird like this. There have been efforts just like that to basically push for standards of public service obligations of commercial broadcasters. The grand total of that, as far as actual policy implementations, have been zero. They've basically been put into a file and dusted off every couple of years to be brought out when the FCC basically has to. And there's been precious little in the way of actually implementing that. And that's been a serious cause of concern, not only by the Benton Foundation and a host of media advocacy and media justice groups about this stuff, but also larger concern with regards to the community generally. And there's been precious little in the way besides just moving your lips about this stuff from the commercial broadcasters. And that's a shame. And that's got to be something that could also be proposal number 6 on this list. It's like, okay, you're not going to get this money. You've got to abide by these standards regarding whatever, emergency access or airing public service announcements or what have you. I mean, you're getting this humongous windfall. Use it for the public, damn it.
And that raises a question that maybe I can address to Phil, which is, how is television going to change after the conversion? Like, what can we expect in terms of textual shifts? Because we're talking a lot about sort of policy issues, and this kind of gets to your question, which is, the multicasting only, the technology says that you can multicast in lower quality, or you can, unicast in this high definition. So
when this was originally being sold, diversity did not have the starring role in the early discussions of moving to this standard. You look at stuff from the mid 90s, from 97, 98, 99, and it's quality. It's cinematic quality. We're going to make television look more like the movies. And of course, I sit there and I look at movies on my laptop and I say,
it's good enough.
this is fine. And indeed, in some ways, this kind of gives the lie to old debates over quality back in the 30s and the 40s, which is, well, there's plenty of things that I'm willing to watch in small pictures and bad resolution, and indeed, we're willing to do that more and more these days in some ways. And so there's this sort of divergence in our notions of what is acceptable quality for television. Many of us would like to watch cinema-style television on a 42 or 50-inch LCD screen. That'd be great. I don't need it for a lot of the television that I watch. And in many ways, I'm too cheap to go out and buy one of those things right now. And so now all the programs that I watch in 1.33 are going to suddenly be smaller by being shoved into letterbox, and it's going to have an impact on our textual forms that we're used to. And I kind of like the box as opposed to the rectangle. I mean, the television is the medium of the close-up in some ways, and as you said,
as you said, now it's going to be the medium of the two-shot.
Yeah, and the distant two-shot.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're going through a debate right at this moment because we're committed, we're determined that we're going to bring KLRU.TV up by the end of the quarter in some way, shape, or form, or I'll die trying. And we've been talking about with some organizations that can help us, third parties, some aspects of it. And in order to optimize the efficiency of the transcoding of the content for the web, they're proposing that we do our studio production in a different format, at 24p, which our technical guys, half our technical guys love, and half our technical guys are whacked out beyond all reason about. They're threatening to strike over this whole notion. And again, for people like me, come out of the Friday night fights, when I was 5, this whole discussion is so beyond my ken, because I watched Apocalypto on my iPhone. I don't really care. But there are people who they want to register, you know, register the color quality on a pixel by pixel basis, and it's, I believe that that's not how people really care about what they do, and it's going to be interesting to see how it all resolves.
But
I don't know where it goes.
Just for the record, I'm not a pixel by pixel basis, but I bought my first HTTP 2 years ago. I got my PS3, launch came out. It's not that I'm excited about the DTV thing, but I like a more cinematic experience.
Which is great.
Even when I'm watching TV. But I don't know if you go out there and do it like a demographics of, how people like, I don't know any of that. But it is something that I wonder about. I know that, I don't know if you've seen the David Lynch
iPhone
mm-hmm. thing about, he gets all up in arms about it. But I was, going out on the road show with the Alamo, I work at the Alamo Draft House, and one of the crew guys had just got a new phone, and he's showing me all the TV channels on his phone, and he was ecstatic about it. And so, but I'm going looking at him, going, here, I'm going to watch this, and I'm looking at him going, are you crazy? How can you? And I wonder about, what the split is out beyond my own little.
Well, and even more complicated and relevant to the discussion today, I'm willing to bet if you took your surveys about, awareness of the DTV transition and you asked the additional question of somehow testing whether people understand the difference between digital TV and HDTV, I think the level of awareness there would be
Yeah.
And we still get people calling up asking, saying, now tell me about the HDTV stuff that's coming next year.
Right.
Well, that's kind of one of my points about the opportunity and the challenge of educating the public is what do you educate them about?
Right.
Do you educate them as to how to install their box, or do you educate them as to the technical differences, or do you educate them as to what a letterbox is and how I mean, it took me 5 years to educate my own parents as to the fact that they're actually getting more of the image when they're watching a letterbox movie than they were on a Panascan, and those kinds of things, where do you draw the line?
Right.
Where do you educate and where do you not?
Well,
where are the priorities? So.
I tend to take the philosophy of it, as long as people are interested, tell them everything you can.
Well,
and it's that's my philosophy.